because you do not have to be some super genius to do it. You don't have to like invent this new special clever trick every time. The whole point is that there's some simple laws that are governing everything, and that simplicity should just be a guide to absolutely everything you can do. You should understand simple things in the simplest way, then you should understand the second simplest things in the simplest way, the third simplest things in the simplest way, but it's really possible to do things like that. You don't have to invent a special trick for every different problem. You don't have to be scared walking around the intellectual landscape. Okay? You should just have confidence things will work out if you just do them straightforward. And if they don't, that's the rare exception where you'll learn something. So, I think that I may be running out of time. But that one's actually important. Yes.
Very dumb question. When you talk about the size of the universe in the scales that we started with, I more or less what the size of the universe means.
That's the size of the observable universe. So the universe is 50 million years old. And it's just the, you know, we're just getting light from something 15 billion light years away. So that's...
So there's the size of the non-observable universe as well.
Well, so what really gives us meaning is in fact, the fact that the universe is, there is a size in the following sense, that there's an actual distance from which, you know, stars were formed, there's some distance from which we're just getting light from that star, right? There's the furthest away things that from which we just got light. That's around 15 billion light years. Now, you might not want to call that the size of the universe, because if the universe keeps expanding, then we'll get to see things that are going further and further and further out. So you could call it the size of the universe now. So the size of the universe and the age of the universe would be similar things, okay? Roughly related to each other by a factor of the speed of light. So the age of the universe is a sensible question. So we have, it's 15 billion years after a certain epoch, okay? So
if we ask, what is the universe expanding into, that is not a sensible
question? What the universe is expanding into is definitely not a sensible question. So we'll talk about cosmology in one of these lectures. But really, you've seen this, many of you have seen this analogy, it's like the surface of a balloon. The problem with that analogy is that there, at least, you see the balloon is expanding. Maybe an even better analogy is like taking a rubber band. Imagine taking a rubber band and just constantly pulling on it. Put little dots on the rubber band and just imagine pulling on it on a constant way. Then, if you look at the rubber band, it looks like all the points are receding from each other. So it's expanding in that sense. There, it's not expanding into any bigger space. You're just sort of getting more and more rubber band.
You want to sit in the microphone room?
Oh, sure.
You have to get down now. I think you're recording. So.
But anyway, yes, it's not expanding. Now, the fact that the universe is now accelerating actually gives another meaning to the size of the universe, because we'll never see anything more. And so then it's really the distance out to the furthest thing that we'll see. And that's also around 50 billion years.
But that also means that the fact that it is just stretching,
yes,
in some sense, that there is a sort of finite end to its limits?
No, I mean, no, it's, in fact...
One infinity is becoming a bigger infinity, sort of.
Right, it's becoming an even bigger infinity, yeah. I mean, in this picture, it just becomes infinitely large, but you only ever have access to a finite amount.
So apparently, in some sort of God's eye view, the universe is infinitely large, it's expanding infinitely, and it's accelerating. So it's in fact growing exponentially, but you can only see a finite amount of it. So that's already that already begins the confusion, right? Because how do you reconcile these two pictures? Anyway, that's related to some of the things that I was talking about. But we'll have a whole discussion on cosmology. Actually, we'll talk about some of that right now. Okay. So, So we talked about the first two. We talked about the mysteries associated with this scale. And I told you every one of the scales is associated with a mystery. So now I want to tell you about the other two. And actually, the other two have a quite different character than the first one that we talked about. The first mystery that we talked about, I mean, there's an absolute honest-to-goodness problem, right? We do not understand what happens with space-time at very short distances. We don't understand what happens when we scatter particles at energies 10 times the Planck mass. You think you have a theory of the world, you have an answer to that question. We don't have an answer to that question, okay? We don't know. There are these more subtle things that I mentioned. And all these mysteries also become important near the Big Bang, right? Anytime the curvatures become high, all the invariant scales start approaching the Planck length, we have a problem. We don't know what is going on. So the Big Bang is another classic example where the curvatures are just becoming so large, the very notion of space and time is breaking down. The end, right? The question, what came before the Big Bang, is just a meaningless question. Time is breaking down. The whole notion is breaking down as you approach, as you head in that direction. So there's no doubt. We just take the known laws of physics, we put them together, we get nonsense. So something must happen. Right? Something definitely happens. The other two questions have a somewhat different character in that they're not associated directly with some actual conflict with experiment. Okay? But they're associated, on the other hand, with a very, very basic feature of the observed universe, which seems to require some absurd choices for the parameters that go into our description of nature. Okay? Once you make these totally absurd choices for the parameters, everything is hunky-dory. Everything is fine. But the choices seem so absurd that it makes us think we're missing something big. Okay? But I want to stress that it's quite a different, because it's not guaranteed that these questions are good questions. It's not guaranteed that they have, you'll see what I mean a little more as we progress. But they're not associated with an actual contradiction or an actual failure to make a prediction in a scenario where even if we can't do the experiment practically, we can imagine doing. But what does it have to do with? Well, does anything strike you about this picture, about these three scales? Is there any very zeroth order thing about them that you find striking? Yes?
There's a much larger gap between the electroweak and the Hubble than...
Yes, that's one fact. That's one fact. But there's an even more zeroth order fact than that, of which yours is that there are gaps at all, right? After all, we just said, here's this nice microscopic scale, space-time breaks down, blah, blah. Maybe there's something clearly fundamental going on there. Okay. Where do all these big macroscopic scales come from, then? Okay. So why is there a macroscopic universe, given that there seems to be some fundamental thing going on at very, very short distances? Okay. Well, now, this seems like this isn't the question, you know. Like we have all sorts of examples. Like here's a simpler thing: atoms are small, elephants are big, right? This is not a deep principle of theoretical physics to worry about that, right? Okay. Why are elephants big? They're made out of a lot of atoms. Okay. That's. But actually, on when you think about this question. Even this question ends up being related to the mystery that I'm about to tell you. Okay, it's not as obvious as you think why elephants are big. But anyway, something is actually peculiar about this separation of scales because of the following reason that I'm about to tell you, and that has everything to do with the phenomenon of vacuum energy. But let me tell you colloquially what the problem is. Okay. Colloquially, the problem is that there are big quantum fluctuations at small distances. You know, because of the uncertainty principle, at smaller distances, there are bigger and bigger fluctuations. And the mystery is really this. If there are such violent quantum fluctuations at such tiny distances, why is there any coherence over very, very long scales? Why do things, you know, why is there any macroscopic physics at all in a world that's roiled with short-distance quantum fluctuations? those are the words, and we'll see equations that go along with that right now. This is very, very, very simple. It's a very, very simple problem. But that's the deep essential question. There are gigantic short-distance quantum fluctuations. How come there's a macroscopic universe at all? Okay. So what we'll see is that by all rights, this picture should not have looked like this. By all rights, all these scales should have been stacked right on top of each other. Okay. Had you handed a random theoretical physicist the Lagrangian that describes a standard model of particle physics, put them in a spaceship, close the window so they couldn't look at the world outside. Well, this is not quite a self-consistent story. But anyway, then if you did that and asked them to predict what the world would look like, they would predict that it looks like that. They would never predict that it looks like that. Okay? All the scales want to be right on top of each other. So let's see why that is. By the way, just to make a small comment, what's wrong with this world? Well, what's wrong with that world is that we're all black holes. Okay. What's wrong with this world is that there is no, you know, the gravitational force is something of order one. Everything's the black hole. It looks nothing whatsoever like our world. Why is it that in our world we have big macroscopic things? Ignore this deeper question for a second. But why is it that, why is it really, like, let's forget about elephants. We'll come back to elephants in a second. We'll do more of this tomorrow, okay? But why is it that, like, a planet is so big? Planets are made out of atoms. Why is a planet so big? So I think you're saying the right thing. Gravity is weak. Right, exactly. So in fact, there's one small parameter that we talked about is alpha, okay? There's another really, really small parameter, which is g newton times m proton squared, let's say, the force between two protons. That parameter is 10 to the minus 38, okay? And that parameter shows up all over the place. So indeed, the reason why planets are big is because you're balancing the electrical pressure, the pressure of chemistry, versus the gravitational pressure. Gravity is weak. And so you get to build really, really big objects until they're held up just by chemical pressures. Okay? There's a limit on how big you can make any object that doesn't collapse under its own weight from a similar requirement. Okay? So again, it's gravity. So really, there's a limit on how big elephants are coming from gravity. And you can actually parametrically decide the size of the planets and the size of elephants, size of mountains. All of these things, all are just functions of alpha, g newton, and m proton, as we'll discuss tomorrow. But really, the absolute dominant reason why things are macroscopic in the universe is that gravity is weak. Okay? Absolute dominant reason. That that small number, 10 to the minus 38, makes an appearance everywhere. The reason why the sun has 10 to the 57 protons, that 10 to the 57 is 10 to the 38 to the 3/2 power. Okay, so that parameter just ends up coming in over and over and over again. Yes?
Can you use the same argument to say that
atoms are small? Sorry? No. Alpha really sets the size of atoms. Alpha sets the size of atoms, and g newton m proton squared sets the aggregate size of objects that are held together with gravity competing against chemistry. Okay? But most of the things in the universe most of the big things are like that. The reason why elephants couldn't be 100 times bigger is they'd be crushed under their own weight. And where crushed means only breaking one layer of chemical bonds rather than crushing everything. You don't want elephants to break their bones. So that's why elephants are smaller than planets. But anyway, all of these things are very simple parametric things that we can understand. But the dominant thing is that gravity is weak. Okay. So obviously, in this world, nothing is weak. There's no big or small parameters, so there's okay. So one way or another, we have to understand why it is that gravity is so weak. That's the origin of the fact that there can be, the fact that we have these two scales are so macroscopic compared to that one is a way of restating the fact that gravity is weak. But as we'll see, it's very mysterious that gravity is weak as it is. And that's because of this problem of vacuum energy. So let me talk about what that problem is. Okay. So let's imagine putting the universe in a big box. Okay, so the box size is L. And so you know that every single particle in nature, like the photon, okay? The photon I can think of as, I have a separate photon of different frequencies, right? And the different frequencies are just different particle in a box modes. So I have different momenta, P, which are some unit vectors N over L, right? N1, N2, N3 over L. Okay. Each one of these can be thought of as a harmonic oscillator. Okay. So, and so there is an energy associated. And so, what is the frequency of the harmonic oscillator? The frequency of the harmonic oscillator is, this is the momentum. So the frequency would be square root of p squared plus m squared, right? If the particle has a mass m, it would be square root of p squared plus m squared. So this is square root, n over l squared plus m squared. Where again, we're using our natural units, so there's no h bars or c's anywhere. Okay? So there's some energy. There's just some vacuum energy associated with every one of these harmonic oscillators. There's an energy of the vacuum, which is the sum of a half h bar omega. I'm not writing the h bar, but I'm writing the omega. Right? Literally the energy of the vacuum. Okay? So this is the sum over all these n vectors of square root of n squared over l squared plus m squared. Okay? And now, as you're used to, we can convert the sum to an integral when L is very large. I can convert the sum to an integral, and it's proportional to the volume, right? Proportional to the volume of the box. And instead of the sum, I get this volume times integral d cubed p square root p squared plus m squared. Any questions about that step? You see, it has to be this because we know that we're going to replace the sum over these n's just by an integral over all the momentum, right? And, well, this has units of what? GeV cubed. So something has to make up the units, right? So it has to be something of inverse GeV cubed. So that's what the volume is there for, okay? All right, this is very nice because we're computing the whole energy and it's proportional to the volume of the box. So that's good because that makes sense. We should have an energy density, right? There should be some energy density. So what is the energy density that we get? So the energy density of the vacuum, rho vacuum, is E vacuum over the volume of the box, is the integral d cubed p square root p squared plus m squared. This is from a single particle of mass m. If we have many particles, we'd sum over all these particles, right? And there's a half, but anyway, I'm not being careful about halves or pies. Okay? I will be careful about one thing, though. And I'm just doing this for later. It's not critical now. But in fact, the formula is rho vacuum is a sum over all particles. Of integral d cubed p root p squared over m squared. Let me write it like this. The sum over the bosons of root p squared minus m squared minus the sum over the fermions of root p squared plus m squared. There's a relative minus sign. The energy of a bosonic harmonic oscillator is a half h bar omega, and of a fermionic harmonic oscillator is minus a half h bar omega. I could give you a simple reason for this, but it would take me 20 minutes. So let me just assert that and give you a more formal reason for it. The more formal reason for it is if you remember where that stupid half h bar omega comes from when you do the harmonic oscillator in quantum mechanics. It comes from the fact that you start with a Hamiltonian, which is x squared plus p squared. And then when you write it in terms of a's and a daggers, it's a dagger plus a dagger a, right? And then you use the commutation relations to write in terms of just a dagger a, but there's plus a half. Or maybe there's a half here, if that, you know, I don't remember. So this is a half a dagger a plus, a dagger a plus a half h bar omega, right? Now, when you do fermions, you know that they're anti-commuting. You know that they satisfy Bose statistics, Fermi statistics. So instead of having commutation relations, you have anti-commutation relations. And you start with exactly the same starting point, but a and a dagger anti-commute rather than commute. So you get a minus a half h bar omega rather than a plus a half h bar omega. Okay? Like I said, at the moment, it's not a critical difference, but it'll come in one of the arguments I'm about to make a little bit later. Okay? So this is the actual vacuum energy. Okay? The sum of bosons, root p squared plus minus m squared, minus sum of fermions, root p squared plus m squared. Okay. Now let's forget about bosons and fermions. Let's just look at our central object, this kind of integral. And you'll notice something very nasty about it. Yeah. It's pretty infinite. Let's see how infinite it is. Okay. Now, I keep running into nice platitudes, I can tell you. You should learn to love infinities as a physicist and not hate them. Okay? Infinities are your friend. The reason is when something is becoming infinite, it's telling you that something is becoming much more important than other things. And you should focus on the infinite part. It's definitely more important than the other part, right? The biggest problem in physics is to figure out what's important. And when you do a calculation that something is infinite, you should be very thankful because it's telling you something very important. Okay? And you should focus on it. It's not, you know, the old way of thinking about these things, that they're bad and you have to get rid of them, is exactly wrong. The infinities are very helpful, very useful, have a huge amount of physics in them. Because it's how things are becoming infinite that strips away a lot of the inessential details and lets you focus on the important physical things. Now, there is a second aspect to this, which you will not be able to appreciate now, because we're going to focus on precisely the part which is, I'm about to tell you, not very important. But when you see infinities, there's two kinds. There's infinities which are roughly a power law infinity. Okay? So that's mostly what we're going to talk about here. Okay? The power law infinities are fine. They tell you something. And we'll talk about them. What they really tell you about is what we're about to talk about in the rest of the lecture. There are things that are logarithmically infinite, okay? And you should learn to love logarithms. Logarithmic infinities is just, the second you see a log, your mouth should start to water. You know, you should be thrilled that there are logs around. Logs are the best kind of infinity there is, okay? And it's because of a very, very deep and important feature of a logarithm. Something is logarithmically infinite when it looks like dt over t. From some, you know, x to y, right? That's log. So that means that it's not just infinite. It's not just infinite. But it receives equal contributions from every decade between x and y. Okay? So when you have a logarithm around, there's some phenomenon that's there. It's not just happening at short distances. It's not just happening at long distances. There's something that's taking place at all distance scales in some uniform way. Whatever it is very important, you have to understand it, okay? So, and this is a message that comes up again and again and again and again. Logarithmic infinities are phenomenal, fantastic things. When you see a log, like I said, not only should your mouth water, but there's this whole beautiful machinery that you will learn. You'll, you know, wheel it out and you'll conquer the problem at hand, okay? Now, when you have something that looks like dtt, or the kind of thing we're talking about, this is sort of considerably less interesting. Right? Because it's definitely divergent. It's hardly divergent. But all the action is happening right at the end. Right? All the action is happening right at the end, presumably where you don't understand things very well. If you understood things very well, you wouldn't cut this integral off. You'd just do it. Right? But it's only because you think you don't quite understand what's going on that you're sort of trying to cut off the integral. But that also means that the answer that you're getting for it depends entirely on what's going on near the top where you're cutting it off. Okay? And so this is a quite different character. And we'll see an example of this. Well, that's exactly the example that we have to deal with here. Okay, but anyway, so let's go back to this object. And so there it is. It looks infinite. But where is the infinity coming from physically? The infinity is coming from very, very, very short wavelengths, right? Very high p, very short wavelengths. We just went through this big song and dance of space-time doesn't make sense, blah, 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 at very, very short distances, right? So clearly, it doesn't make sense to continue this integral forever. Something is definitely changing, right? So let's proceed by just putting a cutoff, some p max cutoff on this integral, okay? So let me immediately change it to a dp p squared root p squared plus m squared. And I'll cut this off at some p max. Okay? But then what am I going to get for this? What is this integral? What's the leading piece in this integral? Just by dimensional analysis. For the whole integral. P to the fourth, right? It has units of energy density, remember? So whatever it is, it's got units of GeV to the fourth. So the leading piece is P max to the fourth. Very good. Okay. There's actually some subleading pieces to it. What do you think the next subleading piece is? I mean, the subleading piece should depend on the fact that there's an m squared here, right? So what is the subleading piece? There are some formal ways we could do this, right? We could differentiate with respect to m. Yes, the subleading piece is p squared m squared. Okay? There is yet the next piece. What do you think the next piece is? Right. But here is the little surprise, perhaps, although maybe not that surprising. Whenever you do any computation like this in quantum field theory, this is a baby computation in quantum field theory, okay? There's never anything as constant. A constant is a logarithm. Okay? What this really is log p max over m. Okay? So it's also divergent, okay? But only logarithmically. How do you know that? How do I know that? Well, I mean, don't you know that? Isn't it obvious? Well, let's see how we would do this. Let's just Taylor expand this sucker, okay? Where is this thing coming from? The divergence is clearly coming from a region where P is much larger than M, right? So let me just do dp, and let me pull out a p cubed, root 1 plus m squared over p squared, and I'll just expand this, because this is a small quantity. This is dp p cubed 1 plus m squared over p squared plus m to the fourth over p to the fourth. And yes, I know there's coefficients here, but you can work them out. I guess one of them is a half. That one I know. And minus an eighth, something like that. OK, just so you know, I can Taylor expand too. OK. Anyway, there it is, right? So now we see what the deal is. The first thing is dpp cubed of the p max. That's fine. That's giving us p max to the fourth. The second one is giving us p max squared m squared. But the last one is a dp over p. OK? That's the logarithm. So the last one is plus m to the fourth log. OK? I stress that this is there precisely because you might think that that coefficient and that coefficient, I really have no right to believe this answer for those coefficients. Why? Because exactly what I said. I mean, we're putting this Pmax because of some mysterious quantum gravity, some reason, blah, blah, we don't know. That things make sense, et cetera, et cetera. But presumably, exactly what's going on out there will affect precisely what these coefficients are in some way. Okay? So maybe they will, maybe they won't. Maybe we'll just use this as a guide to how big to expect the effect is. Okay? But I'm just pointing out there's a piece of this which is there's no way it's infected by that. Okay? This piece is coming equally from all scales. Some of it, a little bit of it is coming from right near the Planck length, but most of it is coming from the huge distance between the Planck length or whatever this Pmax scale is and the mass of the particle that we're talking about. Okay? So there's really a completely reliable part of this calculation. But, yeah?
Sorry. How can you assume that the log part is contributing at all scales if you use the fact that P was large?
I mean, the log scale is much larger than that. I mean, at all scales, much larger.
Yeah, but you use the fact that P was large to Taylor expand, and that's where you.
I mean, at all scales between P max and cap. Yeah, not scales beneath that, but all scales between P max and F. Okay, anyway.
So that's the answer. So let's look at the biggest piece first. I'm doing this because every one of these things is going to be helpful. But let's look at the biggest piece first. The biggest piece goes like P max to the fourth. Okay. All right. Now, I just told you that we have this beautiful theory. It works. Everything is fine. It's not waving a red flag or a white flag or anything until you get to the Planck length. At the Planck length, it's waving a red flag. So if we just take the theory we know and love, and we just do this up to the Planck length, if I say P max is M Planck, then I get an energy density for the vacuum, which is M Planck to the fourth. Okay? Now, it doesn't take much to see this is a pretty gigantic energy density for the vacuum. Okay? It is 10 to the 19 to the fourth power larger than the pressure inside a neutron star. Okay. And furthermore, this kind of energy density for the vacuum, yeah.
We're saying this because that's the only part of the calculation that's reliable, and the other parts have to be positive.
Oh, I don't even know if it's positive or negative. So this is an estimate for its size, but it's an estimate for its size coming.
All it's saying is that there is an enormous amount of energy just in the vacuum, just in all these harmonic oscillators. And if I just take all the ones that I can trust, maybe we can stop it at a tenth of the Planck mass or a hundredth of the Planck mass, somewhere where you think we can trust what's going on. Yeah.
Oh, so you're saying all the terms, the units end up the same?
Yes, units are all the same, right?
So you're not going to be collecting.
I'm in fact starting, I went out this far just because I'll need them all for later arguments. And I'm starting with the biggest one. This is the biggest one. That is the biggest one. Okay. Now, in a world without gravity, you could say, well, who cares? This is just the overall energy density. You can add and subtract energies, right? We can't measure the overall magnitude of the energy. That's not true in the presence of gravity, because energy gravitates. So in fact, this energy density of the vacuum would give rise to some curvature of space-time. Now, we could write down some equations for it, but just without any thinking, what curvature of space-time? It doesn't matter if it's positive, negative. What curvature of space-time are you going to get out of this?
A very large one.
Right. I mean, but what as a length scale? Planck. Nothing is every. The word here is Planck, Planck, Planck. Everything is Planck. Okay? So I have a Planckian curvature. So what does that mean? That means either the universe is crumpled up, so its typical size is 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, or it's explosively expanding, so that it's doubling in size every 10 to the minus 43 seconds. But the typical thing is Planck. Okay? So this energy in the vacuum is very far from being innocuous. Very far from being innocuous. Now, our universe looks nothing like that. Our universe is this nice, big, almost flat universe. It's you know, has a typical curvature of 10 to the 10 years, light years. 10 billion light years is a typical curvature scale. Not 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. Yes.
I'm just curious why, again, if this is the energy density of the universe, but it's like isotropic and kind of uniform everywhere.
Yes.
Why do you think there would necessarily be curvature?
That's because every energy gravitates. So, if you want to see what more formally what this is like,
this energy of the vacuum turns into what's known as a cosmological constant. And it really has energy density. I mean, it has non-zero energy density. And so it just, let me give you a simple example. So if you want to know how the universe is expanding, let's say you have, we're just talking about cosmology. Really, all these things should derive from GR. But as usual, with these very basic equations, you get the same answers if you just do a very naive Newtonian treatment, even though the words and the concepts are totally wrong, because the answer is given by dimensional analysis, more or less, you're always guaranteed to get the right answer. Okay? So imagine a Newtonian picture of the world where you have where literally it's an expanding sphere. That's not what it is. Definitely not what it is, but it'll let us get the right equation. Well, you know, the size is set by when the recession velocity is becoming the speed of light. So if we're just balancing the kinetic and potential energies against each other, you get this equation that says that r dot over r squared is g newton times rho. Okay. You see, that's the only thing that makes sense by units. Anyway, so this is what you get from a very simple Newtonian calculation. More or less exactly the calculation that we did a second ago. That tells you the escape velocity, which is r dot, in terms. So this is saying v squared, r dot squared, is g newton times the mass, which is rho r cubed, divided by r. Okay, that's the same escape velocity formula. Okay. So if I just rewrite it, I get that. Okay. Now, what happens is if this has got ordinary matter, then as the universe expands, rho is getting smaller. I have the same number of particles, right? But the energy density is getting smaller. So rho is going like 1 over r cubed. But if you have vacuum energy density, the energy density is the same. It's the energy density in the vacuum. It doesn't matter how much bigger the space is getting. The energy density is always the same. So rho is a constant. If rho is the vacuum energy, then, so let's just say we only have vacuum energy, then we have r dot over r squared equals g newton rho vacuum. And that's a constant. Okay, so we can solve this equation for r. And you can see that r is exploding exponentially. So that just shows you that even energy density, a constant energy density, if it's positive, leads to the universe growing, exploding exponentially. Okay? And the doubling time, the e-folding time, is given by, well, the inverse of that quantity. Okay? If the vacuum energy is Planckian, every word is Planck, this means that the universe, the e-folding time for it to grow by a factor of e is 10 to the minus 43 seconds. Okay? Yeah?
Wrong with, a universe that looks flat on large scales, but has very large
curvature. What's wrong with this is that this is a picture, not at small scales.
This is the energy density of the vacuum, and the vacuum is translationally invariant. Okay? So this is in fact the other way around. It's the curvature on the very largest scales. Okay, it's so well. This is saying there are no large scales. Everything gets curled up to the Planck scale. So if you have this gigantic, let me say it another way. If you have this gigantic vacuum energy, once the universe starts expanding, this vacuum energy starts dominating over all the other energy there is, because everything else dilutes. So if you have any source of inhomogeneity, you're sitting there, table sitting there, okay. As the universe expands, those get diluted, whereas the vacuum energy is sitting there. So very quickly, it just dominates, and you get a totally homogeneous universe, which is curled up. Oh, not curled up, but has this gigantic rate of expansion. And it's diluting everything in its path.
Are you talking
it's not a small universe. It's an infinitely large universe, but it's expanding at this explosive rate. If this energy density was positive, then what you get is an infinitely large universe, which is exponentially expanding, where the e-folding time for the expansion is the Planck time. So the space-time curvature is Planckian. The physical spatial size is infinite.
Very much spatial curvature, or
very... No, it's space-time curvature. So the space-time curvature is gigantic.
So you have to have large expansion as well.
Yes, that's right. So in this universe, it depends on how you slice it, but there are some ways to think about the spatial curvature is zero, but it's expanding at a gigantic rate. Our universe has low curvature in every sense. Spatial curvature, space-time curvature, everything is small. Yes.
Does the vacuum have a pressure?
Yes, it does. In fact, the pressure is exactly negative rho.
Does it affect this?
In fact, that's what makes this consistent. Yes, it has a negative pressure. One way we know that this has to be the case is if you imagine what the energy momentum answer has to be associated with the vacuum. Just think. You know that in gravity there isn't just energy, right? You know that there's an energy density even. What you have is a whole energy momentum tensor, right? So what could the energy momentum tensor possibly look like if you have the vacuum?
Plus
G. Even on general grounds, if it's a vacuum, you can only have one thing. It can just be proportional to the vacuum tensor, nothing else. No other anything, right? So this is just some number times eta mu nu, times g mu nu. And if you're anywhere near flat space, let's say you're ignoring g Newton, if you're anywhere near flat space, this is, you know, lambda, negative lambda, negative lambda, negative lambda. Okay? So that's rho, and here's p. So rho equals negative p. It's a funny negative pressure thing. Okay? I deliberately didn't talk about the pressure because I just wanted to make this argument as quick as possible. But really, we didn't even need this formula. It's a nice formula to know, but we didn't even need this formula. We know if everything is Planckian, the space-time curvature is going to be Planckian, and that's orders of magnitude off from what we see in the world around us. So this is what you get from a back-of-the-envelope estimate. Now, before the mid-90s, people thought that, look, this is just a gigantic problem. And we have an observational limit on what the cosmological constant is. And there was an observational limit on what the cosmological constant is, that it had to be less than around 10 to the minus 120 in Planck units. Actually, what this is a number is around 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to the fourth. This number, 10 to the minus 3 electron volts, is one of the numbers you should know. There's a few numbers. There's m proton is a GeV. And 10 to the minus 3 electron volt is every number about the universe on large scales, okay? Roughly. You want to know what is the temperature of the microwave background? It's 10 to the minus 3 electron volt. What is the energy density, the average energy density of the universe? 10 to the minus 3 electron volt to the fourth. What is everything, you know? The universe is filled on large scales with some magnetic field. What is the size of that magnetic field, roughly? 10 to the minus 3 electron volts squared. Okay. We just have to get the units right and shove in the scale 10 to the minus 3 electron volt, and you'll get the right answer over and over again. Okay, but that number is evidently way smaller than the Planck mass, 120 orders of magnitude smaller than the Planck energy density. Okay? Now, this was the status in the early 90s. And I think if you polled the most theorists, they would say, clearly, we're missing something gigantically big. Okay? And whatever it is going to make it, this is lambda estimate. And if the estimate and the actual value differ by 120 orders of magnitude, well, what do you have to do? Actually, let's, before even talking about what your attitude is, we said we have this theory, right? We have this theory that agrees with everything. So what the heck are we doing? What are we doing with this theory when we just made a calculation of the energy density using quantum mechanics, and we get an answer that's 120 orders of magnitude too big. And it predicts a universe that looks nothing like ours. So what do we do in order to proceed? What do we do? This is what we actually do. Honest to goodness, literally actually do. We say, oh, it's no problem. That's a very important attitude to be pragmatic sometimes. You say, look, that lambda is just the quantum correction. But there was a classical piece too. Okay? And yeah, it's true. In Planck units, let's say you really do the calculation, and this is 2.3617 dot 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 dot. And I'm ignoring there's 120 decimal places, and 121st decimal place, there's a 4, 6, 9. So let's say someone works very hard and figures out that that's the quantum correction, a good version of the calculation we just did. You say, oh, it's no big deal. Lambda classical just happens to be minus 2.3617 dot, 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 dot. And you just force them to agree to the first 120 decimal places. You can't stop me. I can do it. You know, I can keep going. There it is. No problem. Done. We agree with observation. The end. Okay? You can't stop me. All right? So what I really observe is some net cosmological constant. Okay, now I can come to the attitude. Now you see people's attitude back in the early 90s was that, okay, this sounds a little bit crazy. For obvious reasons, this is called fine-tuning, okay? And it's really like walking into a table and seeing a pencil standing on its tip, just on the table, balanced within a 10 to the minus 120 degrees of vertical, okay? So now it could be that way. There's some initial conditions. You could set it up. It could be that way. Okay? So it's not inconsistent. It's a solution of Newton's laws. Okay? It is not inconsistent. So this is also not inconsistent. Now, just a small comment. Let's say this hadn't happened. Let's say things were just a little percent different. Okay? So in other words, imagine taking everything to be exactly the same in nature, but let's say changing the electron mass by 0.1%. If we change the electron mass by 0.1%, then we change this vacuum energy by a tiny bit, right? But that tiny bit is not tiny, right? It'll take this 120 orders of magnitude, and it'll give us something still gigantically bigger than what we observe. So it's finely tuned in the sense that if you do it in one mental universe, then in any slightly different universe, it's not going to work. Okay? So it's a real fine adjustment of two things in the theory that have nothing to do with each other. There's the classical piece that's sitting there, and it looks like, for some mysterious reason, it's just perfectly finely tuned to cancel the effect of the quantum correction. Okay? So again, no one can stop you from doing it. And when we say we have the spectacularly successful theory, blah, 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 we've done this. Okay? We do this, and we proceed. And there's nothing wrong with it. It doesn't contradict an experiment. It isn't but most people's attitude back then was like, look, okay, maybe this is happening, but clearly there's some deep and magical conspiracy. There's some principle we don't understand that forces it to be the case that this is exactly negative that. We're going to discover some magic mechanism that will force that to be true. Because how crazy would it be for there to be some mechanism that makes them agree to the first 120 decimal places and fail to agree at the 121st? Okay? This is why it was such a shock for people to discover that the universe was accelerating. You see, with the universe accelerating, the best explanation for it is that there is a non-zero vacuum energy. Remember, we just showed you that causes the universe to grow exponentially. That's perfect to explain the acceleration of the universe. Okay? There's lots of competing ideas for it. None of them are remotely as good as this one. Okay? The only weird thing about it is it requires lambda not just to be smaller than 10 to the minus 120 implying to the fourth, which would have at least been consistent with zero and the fantasy that there was some as yet to be determined magic mechanism to do with quantum gravity that solved this problem. But it's actually equal to some crappy number, 10 to the minus 120 implying to the fourth. In other words, this cancellation isn't even perfect. Okay? And somehow this is agreeing to the first 120 decimal places and disagreeing at the 121st. All right? So one possible solution is imperfect fine-tuning. Okay, so, all right? And you can't stop me, you know, and that's what we do. That's what we do. Now, it's really a good thing that the intelligent designers haven't really caught on to this problem. Because this is a way, way better argument for the existence of a kind deity than anything else in science. Okay? This is also a case where we don't actually have a much better answer right now. Okay? But it's really true. If things were a little bit different, then we'd be dead. Okay? If you just look at the bare facts, you just look at the parameters of the world, this is one of the fundamental things in the world, right? It looks like a colossal 10 to the minus 120 accident that we exist. If things were a tiny bit different, then the universe would be expanding explosively and we wouldn't be around. Okay? Yes?
That's a little circular. Given that we are around, the anthropic principle basically, we can only observe this.
We'll talk about that in a second. These are just the facts. Okay?
Then there's a question of what the interpretation of the facts is. But these are just the facts. Okay? So, this is a mystery. As you see, it's not quite the same kind of mystery as the quantum gravity problem because it has a solution. The first solution is, you know, it's just what it is. It's a parameter, you go out and you measure it. It's all in your head. You say, this part comes from quantum mechanics, that part comes from something else. It just has a tiny size. You go out and you measure it, you're done. Okay? But it makes you incredibly uncomfortable. It makes you incredibly uncomfortable that this parameter naturally wants to receive contributions that are gigantic compared to other ones. Yes?
Do they actually have to disagree at the 121st decimal?
Yes. If you want to interpret the acceleration of the universe as being due to a cosmological constant. Okay. The fact of the universe, that's what I said. Before we knew the universe was accelerating, you could still entertain the fantasy. But these things canceled. And no one knew why they canceled anyway.
Right? So it's not this was and was and is considered the greatest problem in theoretical physics, I think. Because even greater in a sense than when someone hands you a 120 order of magnitude problem, you don't walk away from it. this is a real gift. This problem is a real gift because it's incredibly simple to state. It's a direct consequence of putting together quantum mechanics and relativity, right? And it just immediately gives you this gigantic problem. So there's something up. Okay, there's something very, very important up. When you have a 120 order of magnitude problem, it has some explanation. It means something. Okay. So now, I chose to emphasize this problem first because it's the biggest problem. And you know, nowhere in science ever has there been such a bigger disagreement between a back of the envelope estimate and the right answer. 120 orders of magnitude is really bad by anyone's standard. Let me just emphasize how bad it is. So let's say we don't go, we haven't even been to the Planck length, right? This cutoff Pmax shouldn't be the Planck, maybe shouldn't be the Planck length. Maybe something is changing earlier. Okay? Where would it have to change? Where would it have to change? Let's say we put it to where we have been with experiments. Where have we been with experiments? We've been down to distances around 10 to the minus 16 centimeters, 100 GeV. Okay? Let's say you put in 100 GeV to the fourth. That's still really big. 100 GeV to the fourth compared to 10 to the minus 3 electron volt to the fourth is 10 to the 60 times too big. Not 10 to the 120 times, but 10 to the 60 is plenty bad. Okay? So even if we put in the physics up to the scale that we've seen, even then, this is a gigantic level problem. There's one last thing. You might say, well, maybe for some reason, and this... This argument is so bad, I'm not even going to infect your minds with it. Never mind. Actually, it's better that you not know it, so I don't have to deal with it in the future. It's such a crappy argument, I'm doing you a favor. You can ask me later. Okay. So, now, there's a close cousin of this problem, almost identical cousin of this problem, that comes from the next term in the expansion, okay? So, this is called the cosmological constant problem. Okay? And loosely, this is the question, why is the universe big? Why is the universe old? Why is the universe big? Why is it flat? Why is it nice? And really, as you see, it's an instantiation of the general question, how can there be a macroscopic universe when there is gigantic short-distance quantum fluctuations? That's the big question, right? That is the big question. But let's go to the next term in the expansion. Lambda is p max to the fourth plus p max squared m squared plus dot, dot, dot. Okay? Ah, by the way, let me say one other thing about this. I just told you this is a generic feature of any theory, right? So you have to, if someone just hands you a random theory, you have to understand how the heck it is that the cosmological constant is small. It's the first question. The absolute first question that you should ask. Someone says, I have a theory of the world, a theory of everything, everything is fantastic. You say, thank you so much. Please tell me what makes the cosmological constant small. That's question number one, okay? Absolute first question. So, I mention this again because of general approaches to quantum gravity. There are approaches to quantum gravity that say that you just take general relativity and you quantize it. That's it. Off you go. Just go do it. Great. So what is their answer to the question? Why is the cosmological constant small? There isn't one. Okay. So, and that's fine because if you, and you should always be very, you know, you should always ask people the simple physical questions. One of the reasons they don't have an answer to the question is because in the fine print, they don't actually ever get space-time at large distances either. So they don't even have this is left as a future problem, how to get space-time out. Anything that resembles our flat space, okay? But if they ever succeed, this is very important, if they ever succeed, then you have to ask, you pulled off a major miracle. You know, if they come along and say, we've done it, you say, that's amazing, you've also solved the cosmological constant problem, thank you, tell us how you did it, okay? They have to have an answer to that question. There's no way you get a nice space that looks like our space without having some understanding of what happened to that damn cosmological constant. Okay? Now, the string theorists have an answer to this question. Okay? The string theorists have an answer to the question in the things that they study in string theory all the time. You see, one of the good things about string theory, even though it doesn't describe the real world, is it describes worlds which are sufficiently close to the real world where a lot of the same problems and a lot of the same questions can be asked. A lot of the same mysterious questions are equally mysterious in these toy worlds as they are in our world. Okay? So for example, if you have a world that's 10-dimensional and supersymmetric, doesn't look very much like our world. However, in that world, the question of what happens at short distances when you scatter things, quantum mechanics, breakdown of space-time, and so on, those questions are identical in those worlds as they are in our world. Okay? So at least some subset of the questions are very similar. Now, this is why these ingredients go into string theory. You see, you hear the word supersymmetry all the time when people talk about string theory. And the reason is, and this is why I was careful to talk about that issue with bosons and fermions, is that, remember in our formula for the vacuum energy, we had this integral v cubed p, and I said there was a sum over bosons, root p squared plus m squared, minus the sum over fermions, root p squared plus m squared. Well, there's one situation in which you might be guaranteed that this is zero for a good reason. Okay? It can be guaranteed if it's zero if for every boson of a given mass, there's an equal number of fermions of a given mass and vice versa. Okay? That makes the vacuum energy zero for a good reason. And And that's because there can be a symmetry that exchanges the bosons and fermions into each other. That's what supersymmetry does. Supersymmetry guarantees that there's an equal number of bosons and fermions for any mass, and it makes everything degenerate. Okay? So it pulls off many tricks at the same time, but one of them is it makes it possible to even talk about a nice big flat space. The cosmological constant isn't the big thing that, you know, you don't have to solve it by a magic trick. It's solved by supersymmetry. Okay? So it's possible to have a nice big flat space and have it be supersymmetric. And that's guaranteed by symmetry. Yes?
Actually, because it says it's zero, it doesn't say it's a finite number other than zero.
No, I'm not talking about describing our world. I'm not talking about describing our world at all. I'm backing up. I'm saying, imagine some toy imaginary world which is exactly supersymmetric. Okay? It becomes much easier to talk about quantum gravity in a world like that. Why? Because immediately it's at least guaranteed that if you get anything that looks like space, it can be big, it can be flat, it can have vanishing vacuum energy. It solves the cosmological constant problem. Okay? I'm contrasting that with approaches that just go ahead, no supersymmetry, no nothing. Right? There's got to be some magic to solving the cosmological constant problem. If you're not putting any magic in, you're either not going to get anything decent out, or somehow magic has got to come out of nowhere. Okay? Whereas at least here, I'm explaining why supersymmetry is so ubiquitous in string theory. String theorists all the time are talking about spaces, they have space, infinite spaces, they scatter things. It looks like our world in many qualitative ways. Okay? The reason they can manage to do that is because of supersymmetry. Supersymmetry gives theoretical control and lets you have vanishing vacuum energy for a good reason. It is not good enough to solve the problem in our world, because we do not have boson and fermion degeneracies. We don't see a partner for all the partners for all the particles that we've seen with opposite spin. And we have not seen that. And if you just put in the mass gap that you have to have between the ones that we've seen and the ones we haven't seen,
even if we never see them, okay, even if they're just around the bend, it's still too much. Okay? That's the estimate we did a second ago on totally general grounds. We said we'd been to 10 to the minus 16 centimeters. That gives us the vacuum energy, which is 60 orders of magnitude too big. So this does not solve the problem in our world. But it explains why supersymmetry is somehow tied in to the question of getting large space. Okay? Flat spaces. Supersymmetry guarantees, amongst other things, not only is it a nice symmetry, it also makes it possible to have infinitely large spaces. In other words, supersymmetry uniquely controls these violent short-distance quantum fluctuations and makes it possible to have macroscopic physics consistent with these violent short-distance fluctuations because it perfectly cancels them. Okay? Yes?
Is there, and I'm sorry if this it hits upon what you just said. I'm just trying to understand here. Is there any way, then, that supersymmetry could be... How does that fit into our world?
I mean, okay, that's just what I'm talking about now.
Oh, okay.
We'll be talking about that now. But I was just saying that supersymmetry does not solve the cosmological constant problem. Okay? So
supersymmetry alone does not solve it. I was just explaining why it is that in a reverse sense, it helps us understand why supersymmetry is so ubiquitous in theories. Yeah. In theories of gravity that make sense. In theories of gravity that allow us to make progress and calculate things and look roughly like our world. Those theories all have supersymmetry, perhaps because we're looking under the lamppost, but it's really buying you something. It's making it possible to have nice big flat spaces in a way that without supersymmetry is a very deep mystery. So, you know, we are allowed as people, you know, fitting constants, we're allowed to do this fine tuning and proceed. And that's what, as I said, we do. We just do it and we go on and we make predictions for other things and everything is fine. But if someone comes along and says, here's my theory of the world, here's the Lagrangian, I'm quantizing it, tough, I'm done, then you're saved. That's great. You solved the cosmological constant problem somehow. Please tell me how you did it, right? There needs to be an answer to that question. And the answer in string theory is, I'm sorry I'm not describing the real world yet, but in the worlds that I am talking about, the answer is supersymmetry. Okay? So at least it's an answer. It's some partial progress. Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Assume we were dealing with a three-dimensional sphere.
Yes.
But now you are trying to say that in supersymmetry you will get zero. So
yes.
What about the difference in dimension? Is it going to have the same metric and the same measurement?
Well, all you have in different dimensions is that would be a DDP. But it's always root p squared plus m squared. Okay. And it's always a relative minus sign between those on the interpreter. So in any number of dimensions, it's always the same. Okay. Anyway, that's the CC problem. And finally, let's talk about its poor cousin, known as the hierarchy problem. So I told you, so this CC problem is really a question about that separation of scales. Why the hell is that separation of scales so big? Between the size of the universe and the quantum. Okay. And finally, there's a question of why the weak scale, I haven't quite told you what it is, but why the weak scale is so much larger than the quantum. That's a hierarchy problem. So this I'm going to have to be a little more schematic. But let's go back and look into vacuum energy. And there's a piece that was p max to the fourth, and there's a piece that was p max squared m squared. Okay? Now, this piece we can say, okay, some magic, something or another, I just add an overall energy density to everything, right? And I can get rid of that if I want. Maybe it's crazy, it looks weird, but I can definitely do it. Okay? Now this one's a little more tricky. Well, you might look at it, it's just a number, just another number, right? Why can't I just adjust to make it all zero? It's true, you can adjust to make it all zero. But in fact, the mass of many particles that we know of in nature arise in a particular way. So for example, the mass of the electron actually arises from the interaction of an electron with a field that fills the universe. This you'll learn about more in your quantum field theory courses. But it's the interaction of the electron with the Higgs field is what gives the electron its mass. So the electron mass is actually some dimensionless coupling constant times the size of the Higgs field. The Higgs field has some magnitude. And so the typical mass of the electron, so the mass of the electron is some dimensionless number times the size of the Higgs field. And it's true for many particles. Mass of the top quark, some top quark, this is the heaviest of the known elementary particles. And the only difference is that this number is very small, it's like 10 to the minus 6. This number is an order 1. And that's why it's like the only times heavier than the electron. But all of these length scales, all of these mass scales, are associated with one basic scale. That's called the electroweak scale.
And the length scale associated with that is that 10 to the minus 17 centimeters number. The mass scale is around 100 GeV, or 1,000 GeV, 100 to 1,000 GeV. That's the electroweak scale. Okay? Now, this way of talking is useful because really, in some approximation, at very high energies, we neglect the masses of all the particles. Okay? If you imagine that we're going at very, very high energies, you can ignore the mass relative to the momentum of the particles. Okay? And in such a, and so there is an alternate phase of the universe, actually, where the electron mass and the top quark mass and all these masses are actually zero. It's a much more symmetrical state of the world where everything is massless. Okay? It just so happens that there's some potential energy for this Higgs field. Again, I'm abbreviating a discussion that you've probably seen at a popular level and which you'll see more explicitly in your lectures. But there's a potential energy for the Higgs field that makes the value h equals 0. See, if h equals 0, everything would be massless. But it would make the value h equals 0 not the value that's the lowest energy, but has some other value where it takes on some non-zero size. This is called symmetry breaking. There's a much better way of talking about it. I detest this picture. I hate the way we normally talk about this, but for the sake of time, I'll talk about it in the way everyone does. Okay? Anyway, what's important for this argument, though, is the following. You see, what could this potential be? Well, the potential is just h. You see, just from here, what are the units of h? It's GeV, right? H is units GeV. If I'm writing down the potential, what do I mean by potential? This is, again, an energy density, right? Anything to do with things that fill the universe is an energy density. Everything should be a density. So the energy density is going to have a piece, because it's rolling off here, it has to have a piece that's negative some constant times h squared, and then positive some constant times h to the fourth, and then maybe some other terms, okay? But just dimensional analysis tells us a lot. What is the units of this thing? What are the units of the coefficient of h squared? 1 over GeV squared, or it's GeV squared? Because this is units GeV to the fourth. H is units GeV. So this, whatever it is some mass parameter squared. Okay? Has units of mass squared. What about this guy? It's dimensionless, right? So this is some, let's call it lambdas, dimensionless. And that also tells us why we can throw out any higher things. If we have higher things, let's say I have h to the sixth, they don't have to be over some mass squared, okay? Well, the natural over a scale is some very short distance scale, like the Planck scale or something like that. Those things could be very, very tiny. So we can easily justify truncating to these first two terms. But you see then, since this is dimensionless, the only scale that's entering the problem is that guy, okay? So this M should be of order 100 GeV. In order for things to work out right. Now, let's go back to this quantum correction to the vacuum energy that we talked about. Okay? Yeah.
Well, that's what I told you, is that we understand that the masses of all these elementary particles are actually set by some dimensionless couplings multiplied by the size of this Higgs. Okay? And that just experimentally we determine that to be around 100 GeV. So this is also physically, it's the other thing is the mass of the W and Z bosons, which mediate the weak interactions
or some other dimensionless constants times H. And we know the length, the size of these, the length scales of these interactions are around 10 to the minus 16 centimeters. So that's really a scale that we know, we've seen these particles. And so we know what the typical length scale or the mass scale has to be, just experimentally. It's been experimentally, that's right. And that's part of the standard model. Really, the origin of mass, mass of most of these elementary particles is coming from one scale, which is around 100 GeV. Okay? And the reason why some of the particles seem much lighter is just because some of these dimensionless couplings happen to be small. But there is the actual scale is around 100 GeV. The scale of masses is around 100 GeV. The electron coupling is 10 to the minus 6. The top is 1. That's right. The W and Z are close to 1. That's right. Yeah, top weighs 170 GeV. That's right. That's right. So that's why the typical scale is 100 GeV. Okay? And so the fact that gravity is weak is literally the fact that that scale, you see, as you drag that scale up and down, all the elementary particle masses move up and down. Okay? So if that scale was way bigger, all the mass scales would be bigger, and gravity would be stronger. Okay? The fact that gravity is weak is because the elementary particle masses are small. And the fact that they're small is because this scale, 100 GeV is much smaller than the Planck scale, 10 to the 19 GeV. Okay? Yes?
Why do the dimensions of V have to be GeV to the fourth?
It's an energy density.
Oh, it's a density density?
Yes, because anything to do with anything that's extensive in space is a density.
Oh, okay.
So you don't talk about the total energy, total energy of the universe is infinite, but the energy density is something that you can know. Okay. So this is what it has to be. But now there's a monkey, there's a wrench, monkey wrench thrown into the works.
Because let's say that we have V is minus m squared h squared plus lambda h to the fourth plus some V quantum. That's how V depends on H. Okay? This V quantum is exactly the calculation we just did, right? We just computed how the energy density depends on everything, including the masses of the particles. Okay? So this piece is giving us an H-dependent correction for the potential. Right? M is some lambda times H. So let's put that in. This V quantum has a piece in it that looks like P max squared, some coupling squared times H squared. right? Just from the piece that we computed, the subleading piece. Now, this guy I cannot get rid of by whatever I use to get rid of the vacuum energy, right? Because, you know, I can maybe move, I can add an overall constant, that's fine, but then I can't change the coefficient of h squared. So even if I do, by hook or by crook, I get rid of the first one, then I have this one. Is that clear? Huh? Great. So you can do either one you want, but you're not going to get the... Well, hold on a sec. Just hold on a sec. I just want to say, by adding an overall constant, you're not going to get rid of this guy. But what is the problem? Well, the problem is that that needs to be 100 GeV, but if I put that Pmax to be M Planck, just like we did before, I get a correction to that, which is of order 10 to the 19 GeV squared. Okay? So what do I have to do? Again, so you look at this and say, aha, quantum fluctuations want to make it so that the mass parameter here, this is the quantum correction to that parameter. It's a quantum correction to the curvature of the six potential. And the quantum correction wants it to be the shortest distance there is, the Planck length. Okay? That would, again, be a drastically different universe. That would be a universe where all the scales were on top of each other. Okay? In order to understand why it is that we get the ultimate answer for this, to have that parameter be 100 GeV squared, we do exactly the same thing. We say M squared actual is M squared classical plus this, Pmax squared, lambda squared. And if in Planck units this is 1.34767, blah, blah, we say it just so happens that that's minus 1.3467, dot, dot, dot. And this time they have to agree up to 31 decimal places. 31 is 100 GeV over M Planck squared. Okay? 10 to the 32. Okay? So that's another fine-tuning that we have to do. That's another fine-tuning that we have to do to explain why the weak scale is not at the Planck scale. Yes.
So why was the quantum correction the Pmax squared term?
That's what we got. You see, we determined this is what the vacuum energy is. Okay, let me go through this logic again. That's the vacuum energy. And we also said that the masses of these particles are set by some dimensionless coupling times the size of the Higgs. Okay? So if I just shove that in here, I get some energy density, which is Pmax to the fourth, plus m squared, sorry, m is replaced by that quantity. So by lambda squared, Pmax squared, h squared. Okay? But now this changes how the potential depends on h. Okay? Right. So it just drastically changes how the potential changes for h. So in order to understand why the typical curvature of this potential is 100 GeV, I have to do a fine tuning between the classical piece that was sitting there in the quantum correction to 1 part in 10 to the 32. Okay? So all of these questions, you see it's the same issue over and over again. How can there be a macroscopic universe? How can there be a macroscopic universe when there's gigantic short-distance quantum fluctuations? To explain why the universe is so big, we have to do a fine-tuning of 1 part in 10 to the 120. To explain why the elementary particle masses are what they are and why gravity is so weak, we have to do a fine-tuning of 1 part in 10 to the 30. Okay? When you have problems that are this big, as you see, these are, and where are they coming from? They're not coming from some abstruse esoteric location, right? They're coming from quantum mechanics plus relativity, quantum fluctuations, vacuum energy. The most basic things in quantum mechanics and relativity immediately give rise to these problems. Okay? So something is up. When you have a 30 and 120 order of magnitude problem, something is up. Now, yeah?
You're neglecting P minus the power 4.
I'm not neglecting it. Another way of saying it is that if I want to get rid of both of these problems, I have to fine-tune two parameters. So if I want to get rid of both of these problems, I say that B, and I had a constant here, right? I had a plus B naught. And I say I have to adjust, so this is supposed to be the quantum. I have to adjust V naught, adjust this to an accuracy of 10 to the 120. And I have to adjust this to an accuracy 10 to the 32. Okay. I can do that. Those are parameters of my theory. I don't know what they are a priori. Okay? I don't know what these parameters are a priori. In fact, I have to fit experiment to extract what they are. So in a sense, you know, if you take that very hard nose point of view, this is not a big deal. You know, I'm just fitting the data, just fit the data. It's just when you like look under the hood a little bit, you get really disturbed that you're not just picking some random value for these parameters. You're picking some ultra special super duper value for them that is canceling something to 30 decimal places or 120 decimal places. And it makes you something wonder that something is up. If I go back to that analogy, then it's like walking into a room and seeing a pencil standing on a stick to almost vertical. It could be that it was set up like that. But it could be that if you look hard enough, you see it, it's like hanging from a string from the ceiling. And there's a mechanism that explains it. That makes it only an apparent fine-tuning that actually has a dynamical mechanism that explains it. Or maybe if you look really closely, you see a little hand is holding it up. Okay? But there's some dynamical mechanism which is explaining. Now, in this case, for this problem, there is an opportunity to use a sort of solution, which is the following. Which is to say, look, we haven't been to P maxes above around the weak scale, right? Just because that happens to be where we are now. Okay? So if Pmax is also around the weak scale, then there actually isn't a problem. Right? Because this correction actually isn't much bigger than the actual scale that we're talking about. So let me say this another way. We are getting this answer by taking a partial theory. We don't know the whole theory of the world. We're just taking the particles that we know and love that we've seen, right? We're parametrizing our ignorance about what comes next by cutting this integral off at some pmax. So really, the whole integral is what we get up to pmax plus whatever comes after that, right? Now, there's a piece of it that we know, that we can calculate coming from particles that we've seen up to some pmax. Let's cut that off right around where we've been to experimentally, which is at around 100 GeV. Okay. If I cut it off right there, then there isn't a problem. Well, there's still a big problem with the vacuum energy. Okay? That's the 100, you know, that's the elephant in the room all the time with these discussions. But if you forget about the vacuum energy for a second, say, oh, it's a complicated problem, it has to do with cosmology, maybe it's just very different, which is could well be. If you forget about the vacuum energy problem for a second, then for the second problem, the problem of the weak scale, Then if we just cut this off at 100 GeV, then we don't actually have an immediate problem, right? We say, well, we've only been to 100 GeV, the contribution up to 100 GeV is not too much larger than the size of the potential than it has to be, so everything is fine. But you make a prediction. There has to be something new right around the corner. There must be something new right around the corner. To see why, imagine there wasn't anything new right around the corner. Let's say you built an accelerator, some super duper accelerator that went up to 100 times a TeV. A TeV is 1,000 GeV. Okay, so that's around the weak scale. A TeV is the weak scale, let's just call it. Okay. Let's say you built an accelerator, you went up to 100 TeV, nothing doing. Nothing new other than what you've seen already. Well, then there is a piece that you can calculate, which would have a Pmax 100 times larger than a TeV. So it would be 10,000 times larger than the natural size. Okay, well then you have to fine-tune one part to 10,000. It's not as bad as 10 to the 32, but if there's a principle that says that things shouldn't be crazily fine-tuned, presumably it doesn't care about the difference between 10 to the 32 and 10 to the 20 and 10 to the 10. It should be something of order 1. Okay, if it's something of order 1, it should show up right around the corner. Now, this is a literally $5 billion argument. Okay, because this is the biggest reason to expect something at the next round of accelerators. If nothing shows up at the next round of accelerators, there is a problem. Because we don't really have direct evidence that we can't get around it anyway, that a sector of the world we really understand is finely tuned. with real actual cancellations that are happening, which we have no explanation. However, supersymmetry, if it's broken, but the mass differences between these particles and their superpartners are order hundreds of GeV, beautifully solves this problem. By exactly the same mechanism we talked about before. Okay, it cancels the vacuum energy. But now that splitting of order hundreds of GeV is fine. That's one example of the kind of new physics that could show up to solve this problem. You see, it's a cool argument because not only does it tell you that something new has to come in, it can't be any old random crappy thing. Okay? It can't be any old random crappy thing. It has a job to do. It has to cancel these huge quantum fluctuations. Okay? You can't just take the standard model and add three new particles to it. Okay? That's not good enough. It has to fundamentally change something about this logic. And as a general rule, every proposed solution to this problem has involved some extension to our notion of space-time. You can see why. You can see why, because the problem has to do with fluctuations in space-time. It has to do with quantum fluctuations in space-time. You have to tame these quantum fluctuations in space-time. If you're going to do that, since the problem, as you saw, very basically came by putting together the words quantum and the words relativity, well, one of the two things has to give, right? No one has figured out how to make quantum give, but people have figured out ways of making of extending our notion of space-time. Supersymmetry is an extension of our notion of space-time by adding the ordinary dimensions that we measure with ordinary numbers, fermionic dimensions that we measure with Grassmann or anti-commuting numbers. And intuitively, what's happening is the fluctuations in the fermionic directions and the bosonic directions are just canceling each other. They're canceling, actually, roughly. I mean, you see it more directly in the equations. The fermions and the bosons cancel each other. But intuitively, it's because there's perfect symmetry between the fermionic directions and the bosonic directions. But you can't fluctuate in fermionic directions. You can't take more than one step because the variable squared is equal to zero because they're Grassmann. You can't have fluctuations in the fermionic direction. So if you can't have fluctuations in one direction, and there's perfect symmetry between them, you can't have fluctuations in the other direction either. So that's the basic reason that we solve a little more precisely mathematically here. Okay. But it takes an extension of space-time to solve its problem. And that's why, even though people have appreciated this problem for 30 years, there have been basically two proposed solutions to it. It's very hard to solve this problem. Random solutions, or random particles, don't work. But so that's it. Those are the two other problems. So if I were to summarize everything that I told you, now I haven't told you anything about proposed solutions to the cosmological constant problem. That's a subject of a lecture all in itself. Some of the ideas, especially the ideas having to do with environmental reasoning or anthropic reasoning in string theory, also immediately lead to physics questions you can work on. It's not just a bunch of philosophy. There's real physics questions you can work on that take us immediately to those mysteries I was telling you about: inflation, quantum gravity, horizons, information, and all of those wonderful issues. But that'll be a lecture all in itself if I get to it. But let me summarize. This is our status in fundamental physics. We understand everything except everything is wonderful, except we don't understand little things like where space-time comes from. We don't understand little things like why is gravity weak? Why is the universe big? So that was the hierarchy problem. This is the CC problem. Is why is the universe big? And more generally, these are actually, the more general question is, how is macroscopic physics possible in a world governed by
quantum mechanical laws with violent short distance fluctuations. So where does the macro universe come from? Okay. How is the macro universe consistent? Possible. Okay. And and the proposed solutions to all of these problems involve some alteration to our notions of space-time so far. They have not so far involved any notions of our alternations of our view of quantum mechanics. So all of these things, so all of them involve, as I said, some modifications to our notion of space-time, even the attempted solutions. Nobody has figured out how to modify quantum mechanics, or there's no yet clear need to modify quantum mechanics, except perhaps for the one set of questions that has to do with the murkiest set of issues of all, trying to understand the fact that our universe is accelerating, and the fact that our universe is accelerating, that cosmological fact that limits the number of observations we can make, that limits the number of degrees of freedom that we have access to, and forces us to ask about how to do quantum mechanics in a closed system, where we can't make perfectly sharp distinctions between system and observer. Okay? So that's perhaps the murkiest set of issues of all. But in between, there's a number of other very concrete issues. What could happen right here? What could happen at the electric weak scale to solve the hierarchy problem? That's a set of questions that will be immediately tested experimentally as soon as the LHC turns on a little later this year. So that set of questions has a nice virtue of being really directly experimentally testable. Some of the other questions can be tested by cosmological observations at very large distances. But anyway, this is the grand sweep, I think, of questions in fundamental physics, which have a very zeroth order feeling to them. And I hope you agree with that. Even if you haven't kept track of every one of the details, this is not a situation where there's some disagreement between theory and experiment and some sixth decimal place of some abstruse, obscure thing, right? These are very zeroth order problems. And they're very zeroth order problems that are just tied into the foundations of physics from the last century. So some progress has been made on some of them, but there's still a lot to do. So let me leave it at that. And starting tomorrow, I want to come back and actually start filling in some of the in-between. Because something that you'll see here is that it seems like these things are very disconnected. They're certainly very disconnected as length scales. But in fact, as you've seen, they're intellectually very closely related to each other. Okay? And so something that you should really aim to do eventually, no matter what you do, and this is an ultimate goal to keep in mind, wherever you start, you're plunking yourself down in the middle of a gigantic intellectual space that you have to start building. Okay? But you want a big global picture of the whole world, right? Everything that we're doing should, in principle, explain phenomenon over this entire range of scales. And so you should always keep that in mind. You should always keep that in mind that you should feel comfortable walking from the Planck length to the weak length, out to the Hubble length, back and forth on any given day. You should feel happy in any one of these places. This is your playground. Okay, this is your playground in this kind of fundamental physics. And so what I'm going to try to help you do in the next lecture is at least the parts that we understand, the factor of 10 here and the factor of 10 here, we'll walk back and forth a number of times between them. So you get some things at your fingertips. And then we'll move on to some more formal topics. And I will tell you what I think the best ways of thinking about aspects of relativity and quantum mechanics are. And we'll see how it goes from there. Yeah.
What are the length scales in natural units?
Huh?
What are these length scales in natural units?
That's an excellent question. You know, it's like, we actually did it all. So, but you should also work out, well, for example, you should work out from the numbers I gave you, you can work out that the energy density is 10 to the minus the electron volt to the fourth. You should know the work all those things out. Yeah, so you should spend, you know, you should convert everything you know in psych to like,
We figured out at midday that maybe your kilogram was not correct.
Is that, well, someone subtracted wrong then. That's the one that's
good. Maybe you told us to the gram. I'm not sure, but...
Well, 10 to the 57... I know the sun is 10 to the 57 g, and I think the sun is 10 to the 33 kilograms.
It's 10 to the 30
or something. Oh, you're right. It's 10 to the 30 kilograms. Oh, so it was great. Very good. So, great. You see? Yeah. So it's, is that right?
So 1 gram is 10 to the 24.
Look up the mass of the sun.
Yeah, I did.
I know the mass of the sun is 10 to the 57 kg. Yeah.
And 10 to the 30 kg.
10 to the 30 kilograms.
Yeah.
Beautiful. So that's what it is. That was a gram. Thank you, Michael.
Okay. 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 Okay